State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. We are in the process of clarifying a particular point that came up on yesterday's program. We heard yesterday from a supporter of the Ingham Animal Shelter Millage, which will be decided today. Penelope Cernglou is a member of the Ingham County Board of Commissioners, a supporter of the millage. And at one point in the interview, Ms. Cernglou asserted that intakes at the shelter have continually gone up over the years, or words very similar to that, intakes up over time. A current state listener takes issue with that claim and emailed me numbers that indicate the exact opposite. So we're sorry to leave you in the lurch, but there was not time to resolve this and connect all the dots before today's program. Suffice to say, we're exploring that and we will attempt to clarify it at some point. Everybody knows that times have been tough in Flint for a long time. Economic problems have been compounded by the contamination of the city's water supply. A new book confronts life in Flint in a way that shows that, in spite of the trouble, many people are sticking with the city. Scott Pohl has more about Happy Anyway, a Flint anthology. What's this about, Scott?
Well, Mark, the book is made up of 24 essays about Flint, written by people who live there and people who've left Flint over the years. We'll hear from one of those essays in a few minutes. First, though, I'll let editor Scott Atkinson explain what he was going for in Happy Anyway. Scott Atkinson, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. What's the idea behind Happy Anyway?
So the first idea was that I'd been writing for Belt Magazine, which is a branch of Belt Publishing, and I knew they did these anthologies about Rust Belt cities. And so the first idea was there should be one about Flint. And so I reached out to my publisher and I said, you know, there should be a book about Flint and I think I should edit it. And she said, cool. So that was pretty much it. And then I was stuck with the challenge of figuring out what did I want it to be. And this was in the fall of 2015 when the water crisis in Flint was underway, but we were just starting to learn how bad everything really was. And there's a lot of national press coming in more and more as time went on, and I realized going forward, I didn't want to do much with the water for a few reasons. One being that it's still an ongoing issue. The book is published now, and we still don't know how this is all going to shake out and what's going to happen. But also because everyone knows about the water, and that's kind of what Flint's become known for. It's, you know, post-industrial town that now has bad water. And I wanted to show Flint as a more nuanced city than that. The idea being that if people are going to pay attention to Flint, these are the other things you should know. So all the writers that reached out to me saying, like, well, what are you looking for? What are you looking for? I said, think of all the things people say about Flint that are true. You know, post-industrial town, bad water. That is the setting for your story. It is not the story. So let's talk about the things that go on here. If you live here every day, you don't spend every waking moment, you know, thinking about post-industrial life. You just think about life. So that was all I really wanted. And I really hoped to get a good cross-section of the city from that. And I think I did.
With a title like Happy Anyway, were you shooting for something that would be uplifting to the people of Flint or present a more positive image of Flint to outsiders who might read it?
I don't know if positive is the word I'd use, just because that word gets thrown around so much. But I think anyone who reads the book will realize it is not a book that is purely uplifting. As the title suggests. I like the title. The title is mine. Well, and I got the title from a story I did for Belt Magazine early on. I had planned on not doing anything on the water crisis as a freelancer for two reasons. One, there was just so much media in town. I'd go to my favorite cafes and, you know, I couldn't park, which people in Flint get really angry if they can't park. but also because I didn't want to feel like I was capitalizing on this tragedy as a freelancer. But Belt reached out to me and they said, well, you know, you're our Flint guy and we've got to do something. So I thought, okay, what story can I tell that isn't being told right now? And so I wanted to try to put the water crisis in perspective in that it is absolutely a crisis and a tragedy and something that deserves national attention. But Flint has been a place that is no stranger to crisis or tragedy of many kinds for a long time. And it was that before the water crisis. It is that also during the water crisis. And if they could replace every pipe and flush out every ounce of water, we will still have homicide and violent crime and mental health issues and problems in the educational system. It is still a city that has many crises. And so I found this guy named Bobby Jackson, goes by Pastor Bobby, and he runs this a homeless shelter in Northside of Flint. Northside is sort of shorthand for a lot of blight and crime. And I knew that he'd been helping people with issues before and during and would continue to. And even meeting him and going to his you know, his modest shelter up there, I didn't realize just how true that was. Because I said to him, you know, Pastor Bobby, you're the water guy. And he says, well, I've always been the water guy. People had to come to him for water before. They might not have been lead tainted, but they were getting their water shut off because it was so expensive, or they were homeless and needed something to drink. He's got a shower in his basement, so people can come take a shower. So it really put in perspective exactly what I was going for. And he's the happiest guy you've ever will meet. I mean, he's constantly talking about blessings. And this is a guy who's, you know, a short walk from a place once called Buick City, where you once had, I think, 27,000 factory workers. It's a big brownfield now. There's nothing there, essentially. And I described him as being happy anyway in that piece. I said, it's the only kind of happy you can be in Flint. You're sort of happy in spite of it all. And you find what happiness you can. So that was what I was going for. I did want it to be slightly uplifting when you look at the front cover. But I also want it to be a very real book. There are two attitudes in Flint that bother me equally. And it is the people who are sort of the naysayers who talk about how terrible everything is. And, you know, Flint is a wasteland because it's not universally true. I mean, of course, there are bad places and there's a lot of work to be done, but there's plenty of good going on. But then also the people who are so positive and they focus on, you know, the dozen or so blocks of downtown. Flint's really not that big of a place. And at least downtown Flint. And they sort of pretend nothing bad is happening because we have, for example, like a new farmer's market and these great coffee shops, which I love and I frequent, but that is not the extent of Flint. So I really wanted to show a more nuanced view of how this city functions.
You brought up the cover. I'm glad you brought that up. I wanted to talk about the photo you chose for the cover. It depicts the Flint skyline at dawn or dusk. Mm-hmm. I can't tell. But in the foreground is a huge pile of rubble, and the photo was shot through a chain link fence.
Yeah.
Tell me about choosing that photo. What was the message that you thought that would convey to readers?
So a couple of things. We had so many discussions about the cover, and there were a few photos we talked about. My publisher, Ann Trubeck, finally made the executive decision to use that one. And I'm glad she did. It's a beautiful photo. It was made by taken by her designer, Shane Gramling, who's just a phenomenal designer and photographer. I had first looked for photos that would sort of capture the idea of happy anyway. There was actually a photo I wanted to use from the Flint Journal that I couldn't get permission for. And it showed this little boy with his shirt off on a sidewalk, just hands in the air, smiling underneath some caution tape. And I thought, goodness gracious, like that is what a juxtaposition there. But they wouldn't let me. So we started looking at other things, and this photo was just sort of always there. And by the end, it was just, yeah, this is the one. And I think it's great, too. I think it does kind of show what we're looking for. The pile of rubble is actually a pile of compost in a place called, a place that is transitioning from a former industrial site called Chevy in the Hole. They're turning it slowly into Chevy Commons, which would be like a big walkable park, funding providing. So they've been doing these big compost heaps out there. There have been some art festivals out there to kind of reclaim the space, but it's still this giant stretch of concrete and gravel. And so I really like the idea that it's sort of, it's showing downtown. You've got the weather ball there. I mean, it's kind of, you have to be a Flintoid to know what that is. But the sort of the farther away happiness of downtown, then it's set against this backdrop of, you know, this place that we're trying to figure out what to do with.
Edward Ted McClelland is one of the writers included in Happy Anyway. We asked him to record some of his essay for us, so he stepped outside his house recently and recorded from his essay called Meet the Flintstones.
The 9/11 Memorial Corner occupies three of the four lots at the intersection of North and McClelland Streets on the vanishing north end of Flint. A cross between folk art and patriotic kitsch, its backdrop is a pentapitch of the Manhattan skyline, with the Twin Towers still the tallest stalks in that architectural garden. A ceramic angel spreads her plaster wings atop the middle panel, while in the grass, more tightly barbered here than in any of the surrounding yards, a statuette of the Virgin Mary bows her head. Written on a billboard are the names of every police officer and firefighter who died that Tuesday morning. A winding path of cinder blocks bears a hand-painted roll call of all the soldiers who never came home from Afghanistan. Our heart and praying hands go out to the world. God bless 9/11/01 America, reads the message on a concrete foundation roadmap we weeds. Since 2001, the 9/11 Memorial Corner has been a labor of love for Moose and Susie Fitch, who live in one of the few houses left on the block. But Moose is 57. Years of hanging drywall have left him with bone spurs on his spine, arthritis in his joints. Allergic to pain medication, he has no choice but to endure the aches that are his trade's only pension. Last winter, the Michigan cold caused him, quote, a massive amount of pain. So much pain that he decided to leave Flint for Roswell, New Mexico, where he knows a Mormon missionary who visited the corner while evangelizing in the Vehicle City years ago. Moose figured he needed $3,500 to make it to New Mexico. That would be enough to fix up his 1991 GMC Safari for the 1,500-mile drive and rent him and Susie an apartment until they could find jobs. He had a check coming from a drywall job that would finance the move. The house would have fetched $25,000, Moose figured. But if he sold it, would the new buyer look after the 9/11 corner? He couldn't include that as a clause in the deed. So Moose decided to give away his house, along with the condition that the new owners tend the corner. Being poor like we are, we're going to be poor here, we're going to be poor somewhere else, he figured. It's a leg up for someone. At first, Moose tried to give the house to a soldier. He went to a VA hospital and a VFW hall, but in both places he got the same reaction. The North End? That's the most violent drug marketplace in Flint. He offered the house to a member of the Flint Area Good News Riders, the Christian motorcyclist group that attends Memorial Day candlelight vigils at the corner. They didn't want it either. Because of the violence and all the hatred, it's been very hard, Moose said. Everybody basically said they don't want to live here because of what's here. But it's peaceful compared to what it was. When we moved in here 19 years ago, the news people reported on drug deals. They talked about it being a curbside drug market. But now all the properties around here are clear, so someone can come in and build the life they want. Having failed in three attempts to give away his house, Moose thought about a young man who'd grown up in the North End, just a few blocks from the corner. Moose had known Javon since he was 8 or 9. When Moose and Susie were building the memorial, Javon traced an outline of the New York City skyline on the platform in front of the mural. Javon was married now with a 6-year-old daughter and a 4-month-old son, but the young family was too poor to afford its own place. Javon sometimes earned money doing manual labor, such as tearing down trailers, but he was unemployed. His wife Cassidy worked 20 hours a week at McDonald's, earning $8.47 an hour. So they bounced around between relatives. They lived with Javon's mom on the North End. Now they were staying with Cassidy's mother on the east side of Flint. Moose called him. Hey, young man, he asked, how'd you like your own house? Javon said he'd have to talk it over with his wife. When he did, Cassidy was speechless. The neighborhood didn't bother them because they lived there before, and they'd only have to pay $133 a month in property taxes. Not being able to afford our own place, we've kind of been going as we go, she said. This means everything to us. It's just so hard to do everything by myself because I'm the only one working. There's only one stipulation. Javon and Cassidy have to mow the grass on the corner. Moose doesn't want to see it disappear under a rising tide of greenery, like so much else that has been abandoned in Flint.
Edward McClelland reading from his essay Meet the Flintstones in the book Happy Anyway, a Flint Anthology. We're talking with Scott Atkinson. He's the editor of a new book of essays called Happy Anyway, a Flint Anthology. One of the things that often has struck me when I talk with people from Flint or when I hear interviews with people from Flint is how tough they seem to be, how much they seem to love Flint despite its problems. They seem to have a resolve to stick it out to make things better if they can. Do you think there's something to that? And if so, do you think it's reflected in the pages of this book?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think it's universally true. One of my best friends grew up in the east side of Flint, which is not a great area, and he doesn't live there anymore, and I think he's fine with that. But at the same time, you do see a lot of people who take a lot of pride in living there. I put this book together thinking of an audience of outsiders. You know, an anthology will typically be bought by that audience of the city, but I just wanted to show people that, you know, it's more than it gets so easily boiled down to. I mean, I've written about, you know, Flint for a lot of different places, and I've written stories, these headlines that kind of boil, you have to have Flint boiled down to these one or two sentences, and it's easy to get that. I think it's easy for people to see Flint as one thing. And like any city, depending on where you drive, it looks very different. You know, downtown Flint is a fun place to be. I work down there. I'm at the university. I work there every day, and I love it. You don't have to drive very far for it to look very different. You drive a few minutes in the other direction, and you're in a neighborhood of old Victorian homes that are well kept up by homeowners that, you know, take a lot of pride in that. My wife and I were looking for homes in the college cultural district once, and we talked to this guy, and the price in his house had gone down a few times, and at some point he refused to budge. He said, at this point, if I sell it, you know, more cheaply, then I'm afraid that it'll be bought by someone who can't afford to keep it up, and I want this neighborhood to stick it out. And so he's still paying taxes on that house because he doesn't want to do that to the neighborhood. I wanted to be surprised, but I also knew there were things I wanted. And so I did solicit some pieces from writers I knew. I wanted to make sure there was a certain level of diversity. So there were certain writers I reached out to because I knew, A, they had good stories to tell, and B, I didn't frankly want a book about Flint be written solely by white people when it's a book that's largely a minority. But then I just kind of let the submissions come in. What my fear was that I was not going to accomplish the mission in getting what I wanted. That I was afraid I was going to get a lot of sprawling essays, you know, musing on the death of the auto industry, which I didn't want. But they were all exactly what I wanted. They spoke to some really big universal themes, but they did it through being very specific. So there are lots of stories about homes. You know, what does it mean to stick it out? What does it mean to leave and to think about that and to still claim it as your home even though you're gone? What does it mean to come back and try to make a life there?
Well, from what you've told me, it seems to me that you've achieved what you were hoping to with this book in terms of reflecting modern day life in Flint, the good and the bad, despite a title like Happy Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing I am happy about is that a lot of that contemporary life, I mean, though it is a very contemporary book, a lot of the history shines through. There were certain things I wanted to include, and I wasn't sure how, like the famous 1936-37 sit-down strike, which basically gave birth to organized labor in the factories. How do you write about that without it being a boring history story? But another writer I know, Katie Curnow, wrote this essay about how her grandmother, there's this picture of her grandmother holding a sign, striking outside, you know, a plant, or, you know, she's a little girl. She's not striking. She's with the picket line. And there's this long family lore of how that's grandma, they think. They're pretty sure, right? And so it's this long essay, not just about the sit-down strike, we get all those details, but about this desperate need to be connected to Flint's past. You were asking earlier about, you know, what does it mean, or that kind of resilience and that, you know, taking on the city. You know, Katie now lives outside the city, even though she feels like that's kind of where she grew up. And so there's this real need for her and her family to feel that deep connection to Flint's history and Flint's roots. So it's about the sit-down strike, but it's also about what does it mean to be from Flint and to take pride in that history.
The book is Happy Anyway, a Flint anthology, a collection of essays depicting life in Flint from Belt Publishing. Scott Atkinson is the book's editor. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
Coming up on Current State, in parts of the Mississippi Valley, scientists are working to reintroduce a fish, often described as prehistoric looking. They say it could prevent the spread of Asian carp. We'll learn about the role of the fearsome looking alligator gar. That's coming up on Current State. Dance Lansing is a collaborative aiming to create a diverse dance community and to enrich opportunities for people involved in the world of dance. Lead partners include the Happen Dance Troupe and Lansing Community College's Performing Arts Department, but many other local dance groups are also involved. This Thursday, Dance Lansing has a presentation scheduled for Wharton Center's Passant Theater in East Lansing. We're joined by two key players in this presentation. Lisa Whiting Dobson is the organization's artistic director. Welcome again, Lisa.
Thank you.
Also, Dr. Juanita Suarez is the associate professor of dance at the State University of New York, SUNY. That's in Brockport, New York, near Rochester. Dr. Suarez, welcome.
Thank you.
I should say welcome back because you're a Lansing native, I understand.
I am definitely, yes.
Well done. We'll talk about that here in just a little bit. Lisa Whiting Dobson, explain for us what a typical season for Dance Lansing looks like. What do you do throughout the course of a year?
Well, the biggest thing we do is our summer dance festival. And in April and May, we do auditions for both choreographers and dancers. Anyone who's 14 years or older can audition. However, mostly we have college students and adults that dance with us. This year we had 70 original works created. The dancers choreograph and work for about 5 to 6 weeks, and then we go out in the community. Last week we did 4 performances, highly staged performances at Dart Auditorium, and then this week we're at Robin Theater, Micah Gallery, Allen Marketplace, we're at Passant Theater, we're at Arts Night Out, we're at Lansing Mall, and we're at the Jazz Fest. So we go throughout the community and present this work. The idea is to get dancers out dancing and to build community support for dancers as well.
What's the larger aim of Dance Lansing here? At the end of the day, what are you trying to make happen?
To develop opportunities for dancers. I've always noticed that in theater communities, and I stage manage sometimes, and I stage manage for both theatrical productions and also dance productions. And with the theatrical community, if you're an actor in the Lansing area, there are tons of opportunities. You can be 3, you can be 80, you can be a professional, you can be a beginner, and there's opportunities for you to work throughout your entire life. For dance, most dancers are tied to a studio. And so once they turn 18, that critical mass goes away, and there's not opportunities for adult dancers. And so many of our dancers leave town, but for those that stay in Lansing, we want opportunities for them to do high-level work, to have audiences that appreciate them, and to be able to stage their own ideas, because dance is so much more than steps. It's an art, you know.
And we will get to Dr. Suarez here momentarily, because you play a key role here in the performance this Thursday at Passant Theater. But talk to us more broadly. What will people at who attend the Passant performance, what kind of performances are they going to see?
Well, with the Passant, that's a little bit different in that we had this residency with Dr. Suarez that she can tell you about, but it's really been wonderful. She's been an instructor. She's been a friend. She has opened our minds to so many different opportunities, but she is going to present her own work. She's done 3 original pieces while she's here, and she also is going to do a lectum of some of her work that she does at the State University of New York.
And Thursday's piece, Dr. Suarez, The Book of Esther, Migrant Reflections. This is a really personal creation, I take it. What's it about?
Well, actually, it's Book of Esther, Migrant Revelations. That particular dance that's going to be performed by the Passant group is based on research I started way back last year when I started my sabbatical. And it came out of a transformative, what I would call a revelation for me. I had been told a long time ago by my husband, who had his past life read by a woman in New York City, who was hired by Roxanne Quimby.
Let's slow down a little bit. He had his past life read. What does that mean?
There are women and men who are capable of reading a person's past lives and telling them the different experiences they lived through.
Okay.
So Roxanne Quimby, who was the former owner but the founder of Burt's Bees, hired John to work for her. And she was so fascinated by him that she wanted to see what his past lives were involving. Mm. So in one of those revelations, she said to my husband that at some point your wife has something to do with Esther of the Bible. Mm. And so I was intrigued. I read the book, did not understand, made no connections. Then I checked out the movie that came out. It was a rough version of the Bible. Reread the Bible chapter again, returned to it thinking...
What movie?
It was called Book of Esther.
Okay.
And rereading, then I said, well, I have to go deeper. I can't just approach this from a surface level. So I decided to take the story, break it down in terms of the characters, what they symbolically meant in translation, and then tried to find if there was a parallel metaphor about Esther that also applied to the migrant situation, because I had been reading about migrants in my sabbatical, because that was the focus, because I used to be a migrant myself.
Of course. Uh-huh. What kind of impact did your own experience as a migrant farm worker have in the creation of the piece that we'll see on Thursday?
Well, it had to do with the sense of displacement. I felt that way and had felt like that for a long, long time, a sense of displacement, being moved from one location to another, learning, having to learn English only back at a time when Spanish was not allowed. I was told when I was 5 years old, I had a note pinned to my sweater my first day of school, kindergarten, and it told my family that I could no longer speak Spanish anymore, and that if I were to be successful in the schools, I had to speak only English, and it had to happen at home. So that particular policy created a huge fragmentation within my family, particularly my parents. My mom wanted me to succeed. My father was very angry. And so there was a dissonance there. And so he kind of withdrew from our family because he felt defeated.
Your father?
Yes. And because he felt like he was being conquered again one more time because of economics, racism, you know, the whole poverty.
Were your parents in disagreement then with regard to the language policy? I mean, one of them thought it would be better for you to immerse yourself and suddenly immerse yourself in English.
Yes, my mother did because she wanted me to succeed. She wanted me to have something that she didn't have. And my father felt like it was like cutting my tongue, cutting your tongue off. And it felt like a slap in the face to his culture as well. So there was that part.
We're talking with Dr. Juanita Suarez, Associate Professor of Dance at the State University of New York, SUNY Brockport near Rochester. She is one of the artists involved in this Thursday's Dance Lansing presentation at the Passant Theater here in East Lansing. It is entitled The Book of Esther, Migrant Revelations. Lisa Whiting Dobson, talk to us about the kind of role that a piece like this has in Dance Lansing.
Well, Dance Lansing, we do a number of pieces. And as I said, this year we had 70 original pieces of choreography. And so throughout the rest of our season, those other pieces are being shown. But we also try to do a residency each year. We try to bring in somebody that is that would be challenging to us, that would bring new ideas to the community, that would grow the community. And so the piece on Thursday is going to be kind of the result of that residency. The rest of what's being shown this week has to do with these other 70 pieces that were created. And I also want to mention that Dance Lansing just doesn't stop next week, that we do 35 performances throughout the year. We do original choreography showcases once a month at Micah Gallery. We do some things at Robin Theater. We do some things at Lansing Mall. We have all kinds of workshops and classes for people. We also have started Choreo Lab, which is an opportunity for seasoned choreographers that are in our area to have a show produced so that they can do a half-hour show of their own. We have 6 people that are going to do that next year. So we're really kind of flourishing in terms of people being creative and getting an opportunity to produce choreography. But Thursday is an example of the high-level experience we try to bring people in our community.
And I would also kind of like to add to that,
sure,
because I have been a member of this process called Dance 2050 Symposium, in which educators in higher education are trying to figure out, will dance survive to the year 2050? And if it will, what will it look like? And we came to the realization that dance in higher education is very isolated and insular. We have people that go to the university. They study in a theater. They have to pay tuition to get into the theater, to get into the university. And we feel that it keeps us away from the community. So we collectively have been working on this for now 5 years. And we came up with this idea that dance has to go into the community. Mm-hmm. Well, lo and behold, I walk into Happen Dance, and what are they doing? They are doing exactly what we were thinking dance should be doing.
Oh, interesting.
At an exemplary level. Mm-hmm. I have never experienced anything quite like this. And so I'm going to be using this as a is a point of focus for a lot of conferences to talk about how there is an actual living example of what we're talking about, how dance will survive.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about the Book of Esther here. Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit more about your history, just a few more details with regard to your history as a migrant worker yourself. How old were you when you started working in the field?
Well, I was born in San Antonio, and we migrated north to Michigan when I was about 2, going on 3. My sister was born and just had been born, and we came up north. And I worked between the ages of 3 and 5. And I worked in the summers with my parents. I remember getting up very early in the morning, seeing my mother making tortillas to pack our lunch, my father carrying me in the cradle of his arms, placing me in the back seat where I would fall asleep again. And then by around 7, I would wake up to the fields that we were going to be working in. And I remember...
3 years old, you were working?
Uh-huh. Yes, and I was not the only child out in the fields. Back then, children were working in the fields then.
What year? What years are we talking about?
1953, 55.
53 to 55.
Mm-hmm. Since then, child labor laws have changed, you know.
Understood.
Uh-huh. And so I remember picking different crops, carrots, potatoes, apples, cherries, mint, beans, green beans. So we basically spent all day bent over, and I remember I was treated as a worker. My parents knew that I could not wander off because they couldn't babysit me. They had to pick. And so I worked, and that's where I basically got my work ethic, I think. But I also received a lot of mentorship through my parents because I was with them the whole time, which is unusual for a child from birth to 5 to be with their parents the whole time, today especially, because most people, they send their, because of finances and the economy, they have to place their children in nurseries at a very young, you know, right after birth almost sometimes. And so I was very blessed to have that, and I think that shaped my personality a lot.
But did your field work end at the age of 5 then? Is that
pretty
what you're
much.
Saying?
Okay. Yes, pretty much.
So at that point, did you start, was your life more conventional, U.S. American kind of experience?
Uh-huh. Well, more, I would say more Western, because my cousins who lived in Texas, who stayed behind, they lived kind of in a compound environment where the parents were living in one house. One of my cousins lives behind that house. Another lives beside the house and then next to that house. And then another lives a block away. So there is very strong communal connections that take place in that kind of living environment.
Mm-hmm.
We moved to the north where we became part of this nuclear model where you live, a single family lives in a single house in isolation from the rest of the community of their own family.
Where in Michigan did you work? You mentioned Mint. I got to thinking whether you worked in Clinton County here.
It's very possible. We worked in a lot of different places that I still
can't. Well, you were so young.
Couldn't remember.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we were up in Hart, Michigan, Battle Creek, Kalamazoo, the Upper Peninsula as well.
I want to, in the time that we have left, I don't want to spoil the experience for people who are going to the performance on Thursday, but I'm wondering if you could talk just a little bit about how you are going to tell your story. To what extent is this a personal story? To what extent is the Book of Esther about you and what you remember and your experiences?
Well, it's a merging of two things, of the personal and the universal.
Okay.
The personal is drawing from that sense of displacement, and not just a displacement as a migrant, but what happens when a person, in my case learning English only, all of a sudden is separated from her family, because that became a quantum jump in terms of class from lower to middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And so that leap separated me from my family to a very large degree. The rest of my family does speak English. But then I went to college, and that moved me further and further until I completed the PhD and found myself looking back and saying, where did I come from? Where are my people?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
as a choreographer, would you mind talking about how you take that experience of yours and translating it into movement on the stage?
Sure.
It's kind of a it's something about which I know nothing.
It's understood.
How does a choreographer? How do you think about taking an experience as profound as that and translating it into dance?
Well, I usually work from the idea of distilling the human language that we perform every day. And what I mean by distillation, meaning you take an idea. For instance, if you're going to create a gesture that suggests that you're hiding, you put your hands in front of your face, right? And people get the message that you're hiding. But And it's a title, there's a title for that. It's called Hieratic Gestures. It was a term created by Dr. John Wilson of Arizona State University. And he said, there's a universal language of gesture that we all understand, like stop means, that means you know when someone does
hold
this.
Hold up your hand.
Yeah. So you take some of those things and some of the things that are not so obvious, you distill them to abstraction so that people get the idea without being literally told this is what it means. Mm-hmm. And they get the feeling, the nuance of that. And we do that because we have, especially in modern dance, but I think this is true of all the arts, that there's a deep understanding that the audience is highly intelligent and capable of understanding what you're trying to communicate mm-hmm. to them.
You're in the middle of a sabbatical year this year from SUNY Brockport to learn more about the Mexican migrant experience, both here in Lansing as well as in San Antonio during the mid-20th century. What kinds of things are you learning?
Well, I'm learning that the migrant situation has become epic. It's a global phenomenon now, and now they're referred to as refugees, and they have different titles. You know, there's a different, a refugee is a person who is escaping a country because of violence or poverty or serious poverty. And the migrant is moving from Mexico to the United States because of poverty and lack of economic opportunities. But I have found that that idea and the concept of migrant is vast. And so that in a literal sense is what my work is attending to. But from my research, I have found and I am finding that everyone is a migrant. And some of us are feeling that migranthood in terms of like senior citizens or people who are have different abilities, intellectual abilities, who are not able to understand like the transmigration of technology in terms of how it's making things really difficult because change is coming at a velocity, a high velocity, as Bill Gates predicted it would be in the 21st century. So many of us are trying to cope with keeping up with the changes so that we're still in the same country we were in before, intellectually.
Just one more quick question here. We're just about out of time, mm-hmm. but talk to us about the young performers who will be performing your piece. How old are these people? How does it look? Are you working with?
They're young. The youngest, Emma?
I think you have a 10-year-old.
10-year-olds, you know, 10-year-olds to
yeah. well,
older.
To stay true to reality there, mm-hmm. it's got to be a young person.
Yes, yeah. And so part of the choreographic job has been to try to translate my experience in language that they understand. And I think Lisa did a beautiful job when she kind of stopped the rehearsal for a moment because she noticed that they kept smiling in the performance of it. And she called them over and she goes, let's talk a little bit about this. Try to imagine what it's like to be asked to leave home with your mother or your father and to leave behind the rest of your family. And you're going to go into an alien territory. You have no idea what's ahead of you. You have no idea how the people are going to treat you. You don't know if you're even going to live through it. Think about that. And
yeah.
So they seem to understand that.
That resonated, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. The work is called The Book of Esther, Migrant Revelations. It is contemporary dance at the Passant Theater this Thursday in East Lansing inside the Wharton Center. We've been talking with Dr. Juanita Suarez, who's the creator of The Book of Esther, a Lansing native, worked in the fields between the ages of 3 and 5 here all over the state of Michigan. She is today the Associate Professor of Dance at the State University of New York, SUNY in Brockport. Lisa Whiting Dobson is Dance Lansing's Artistic Director. Good luck to both of you.
Thank you.
Great conversation.
Thank you, Mark.
And coming right up, we'll speak with fish biologist Dan O'Keefe about the alligator gar. It's a prehistoric fish which could prevent the spread of Asian carp. That's coming up after the break. A large fish, often described as prehistoric-looking, may play an increasing role in a very modern environmental challenge. With a head resembling an alligator, the alligator gar is a sluggish but hungry predator capable of growing more than 8 feet long and weighing more than 300 pounds. Now the less disturbing news. Scientists say it could play a role in curbing the spread of the Asian carp here in the upper Midwest. To tell us more, Dan O'Keefe joins us by phone from Grand Rapids. Dan's a fish biologist with the organization Michigan Sea Grant and the MSU Extension. He's worked with alligator gar in Mississippi. Welcome, Dan O'Keefe.
Hi.
We talk about the environment every Tuesday here. This is this week's segment here. People often use the word prehistoric to describe the alligator gar. Describe that prehistoric look for our listeners, please.
Yeah, the best way to picture an alligator gar is really an alligator with fins instead of legs. They have this alligator-shaped snout, a very bony head, and they have scales that are really different than our other native fish. They're very hard, they're rhomboid-shaped, and they're made out of ganoid. And this is really something that's unique to the gars. It's a very hard substance. It's more like the enamel on your tooth than the thin bone of other fish. So people say they look prehistoric. They really are prehistoric, and they date back to the late Cretaceous. So there were close relatives of the alligator gar swimming around the swamps at the same time that T-Rex was marauding on the land.
Where is the alligator gar found today here in the United States?
Well, they're found in the lower Mississippi River, north to about central Arkansas and northern Mississippi. And they're also found in other coastal rivers west to Texas. The Trinity River in Texas is one of the better rivers for the gar nowadays.
So Michigan is certainly outside the gar's current range, I take it?
Yeah, Michigan's not only outside the current range, it's also outside the historical range. In fact, alligator gar in particular, were never found anywhere in the Great Lakes drainage.
Okay. Now, does the alligator gar then have an impact on the population of Asian carp?
Well, where they live now in the southern parts of the Mississippi Basin, there are certainly a lot of Asian carp, both the big head and the silver carp, which are the two that we're probably most concerned with now. So they're extremely abundant down in the southern part of the Mississippi River. The alligator gar, though, are really much less abundant than they were historically in those areas. And if you've ever been on a huge river like the Mississippi River, you can imagine how difficult it is to catch fish that might be 7 or 8 feet long in this humongous body of water. Mm. So even if you do catch alligator gar, most of them have empty stomachs most of the time. So it's very difficult to do a good diet study in a place like that on a very rare, very large fish. So we don't have a lot of good data on exactly what kind of impact they might be having in places where there are already Asian carp.
But I take it some number of officials feel that it could mitigate the spread of Asian carp further north into the Great Lakes, and I take it that some officials have begun an effort to reintroduce the alligator gar in the northern part of its old historic range. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, historically they used to live in the Mississippi River up to about central Illinois, northern Missouri, and they could also be found at least at some times of the year up the Illinois River into central Illinois. And that's the area now where we see the YouTube videos of carp jumping into boats, and they have the redneck fishing tournament in Bath where people catch them with nets. But that was really, you know, the very northernmost part of its range. And the places where they're now being stocked in southern Illinois are not terribly far from that area. But it really, I think this has gotten a lot of attention lately because the gar is a very large predator. It's our largest freshwater predator in open waters of the eastern U.S. for sure. And they certainly have the capability to prey on large open water fish like the Asian carp. But I think it's also important to note that this alligator gar reintroduction got started as a native species reintroduction, and a nice side benefit of that would be that it could be an excellent predator on Asian carp, but you have to really look at it as part of a holistic program of trying to control these fish. It's not going to be a silver bullet that just eradicates all the carp from these areas where they're extremely abundant.
Okay.
And there's a lot going on there now already with trying to commercial fish them out and use other ideas to limit their spread. So this would be one more tool to that end.
But how much impact do you think that could have on Asian carp populations?
Well, it really, honestly, it would be a long time coming. These are slow growth. Well, they grow fast, but they're slow to mature. And it takes them a long time to get to the size that we see, you know, the old pictures of 7 to 10 foot long gar. Those fish might be 40 or 50 years old. And the stockings that are starting now are really part of a program to try to build up populations, you know, decades in the future. So I don't think it's a short-term proposition by any means. However, if they did become established, they'd be one more native predator out there that would be able to prey on Asian carp, and probably larger Asian carp than other species. But we already have native predators in the rivers that are eating the Asian carp as well, including other species of gar, like the short-nosed gar, which eats a lot of young Asian carp. The problem is they don't get large enough to eat large carp.
We are talking with Dan O'Keefe from Grand Rapids. Dan's a fish biologist with the organization Michigan Sea Grant, along with MSU Extension. He's worked with alligator gar in Mississippi, and we're talking about the potential that alligator gar have for thwarting Asian carp here on upper Mississippi Valley. I spoke yesterday with an alligator gar specialist, Dr. Elise Ferrara, of Nicholls State University down in Louisiana. She urged that efforts to reintroduce the gar not extend beyond its historic range. Let's listen to her comments, and I'll get your response afterwards. Here she is.
A lot of times the non-native fish can exploit some sort of niche within that new habitat, and a lot of times they can grow out of control. I wouldn't expect that with alligator gar because of the temperature in the higher latitudes. They potentially could be released in these higher latitudes and not be able to survive the winters. Unfortunately, there's a lot of unintended consequences when we release organisms, including fishes, into habitats where they were not previously found.
What do you make of those comments, Dan?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. This effort to reintroduce alligator gar is really a reintroduction of a native species, so we would never want to put this fish into places that it never was before, like the Great Lakes. And really, when we look at
that's just an unintended consequences concern. Is that right? We just it's never been here before. We don't know how the impact it could have.
Exactly, and we know that gar eat whatever fish are most abundant. So you wouldn't want to put them in a place that doesn't have Asian carp yet and never had gar, because obviously they'd find something else to eat. And it's worth mentioning that in West Michigan, we have another large predator, the Great Lakes muskellunge, that, like the alligator gar in Illinois rivers, it was extirpated or locally extinct in West Michigan. And over the last few years, the Michigan DNR has been stocking Great Lakes muskies in places they were native, like the lower Grand River and Muskegon Lake and White Lake. And these are large predators. They get to about 5 feet long, not quite as big as an alligator gar, but they have a similar ability to perhaps prey on large carp should they ever arrive.
And I have a feeling I already know the answer to this question, but I'll ask it anyway. Do alligator gars attack humans?
No.
I would not want to be attacked by an alligator. If you're attacked by a fish, you don't want to be attacked by this one, because it is ugly.
It is scary looking, and unfortunately, they had a bad reputation for decades, and people exterminated them. They put bounties on them. They assumed that they ate native sport fish and that they could be dangerous to people, but there's never been a documented attack. And if you want to be safe from alligator gar, just don't catch one and bring it into your boat, because then they can wreak some havoc. But they're really not aggressive towards human. They're a lion weight predator, so they kind of just sit there like a log until a fish comes by the side of their head, and then they'll grab it. But they're really a pretty docile fish most of the time.
We want to thank our guest, Dan O'Keefe. Dan's a fish biologist with the organization Michigan Sea Grant and MSU Extension. He's an MSU grad, and he's based out of Grand Rapids here now, and he's worked with alligator gar in Mississippi. We've been talking about the role alligator gar may play in thwarting Asian carp here in the upper Mississippi Valley. Dan, thank you.
Thanks.
And that's our show for today. Coming up Wednesday on Current State, we'll take a look at a program that's teaching youth how to garden. The Allen Neighborhood Center's Youth Service Corps grows its own fruits and vegetables in Hunter Park, Lansing. They'll give you a tour any Friday this summer. Current State's Katie Cook checks it out. Plus, you've heard of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, which provides benefits to low-income individuals and families. But did you know about SNAP Ed? It involves a series of different food education and cooking classes for adults and youth. For Neighbors in Action, we'll speak with folks running these programs here in mid-Michigan. Those are both coming up Wednesday here on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. Remember, everything we do on Current State ends up on the Current State podcast. Informative, insightful, indispensable, and perfect for dog walking. The Current State podcast, anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.